Hello, and thank you for joining the American Revolution. This week, episode 267, The Battle of Charlotte. And for the last few weeks, we've been covering the defection of Benedict Arnold in New York, but this week we're headed back to the Carolinas, where the war is still raging in the fall of 1780. After the British captured Charleston, South Carolina, British Commander Henry Clinton returned to New York City and, of course, left General Charles Cornwallis in charge of the Southern Army, with Major Patrick Ferguson in charge of raising local militia. Since Britain was by this time fighting a world war with France and Spain, the North American theater could not have nearly as many British soldiers as they did at the beginning of the war. Any successful strategy at this point had to rely on local loyalists to supplement their ranks. The British managed to raise 7 battalions of loyalists in the South in the months following the fall of Charleston. General Clinton was confident that the stronger loyalist base in the South would be enough to secure the region with a minimum of regulars. Despite recruiting efforts, though, loyalist numbers began to fall. Partisan activity grew, while loyalists became concerned that a British victory was not a certainty. General Cornwallis thought he had secured South Carolina after his victory at Camden and wanted to move into North Carolina. This left South Carolina in an even more precarious position. Cornwallis sent increasingly plaintive notes to General Clinton in New York asking for more reinforcements. But Clinton was short of men himself and thought Cornwallis really needed to rely on the Loyalist regiments that he had raised. To take some of the pressure off Cornwallis, Clinton ordered Major General Alexander Leslie to engage in a series of raids in Virginia. Now, General Leslie, of course, was an experienced veteran of the war. You may recall very early in this podcast, Lieutenant Colonel Leslie led a raid on Salem, Massachusetts to capture some rebel cannons a few months before the Battle of Lexington. Leslie had been an officer in America in the regular army since 1768. In 1776, as the British prepared to invade New York, Leslie received a promotion to brigadier and commanded regiments at the battles of Brooklyn and White Plains, and served under General Cornwallis at the Second Battle of Trenton. By 1779, Leslie rose to the rank of Major General and participated in the capture of Charleston. After that, Leslie had returned to New York City along with General Clinton and most of the army. Since Clinton took command, he was concerned that a French fleet would deny Britain control of the seas off the Atlantic coast. But by late 1780, the British had the small French fleet in America bottled up in Newport, Rhode Island, and a larger French fleet trapped back in Brest in France. Clinton felt reasonably comfortable sending Leslie to Virginia aboard Navy ships where his men could raid plantations, as the British had done briefly the year before. Clinton felt that this would presumably relieve pressure on Cornwallis as he moved into North Carolina, since Americans would have to worry about defending against the raids in the Chesapeake Bay. General Clinton's orders specified that Leslie's raids in the Chesapeake Bay were to, quote, pursue such measures as you shall judge most likely to answer the purposes of this expedition, the principal object of which is to make a diversion in favor of Lieutenant General Earl Cornwallis. Leslie would establish a base at Portsmouth, Virginia, and plan a series of attacks that would include not only Virginia, but also attacks into North Carolina from the north. He would also move soldiers upriver inland in Virginia, a place that served as ammunition and supply depots for the rebels in the south. A fleet brought about 2,000 British forces under Leslie, which occupied Portsmouth and Hampton Roads. And while this did cause some panic in Richmond, the occupation did not last long and did not really amount to anything. And we'll get into the reasons for that a little bit later. It did, however, give Cornwallis more confidence of greater British support as he marched northward. Now, following the British victory at Camden, South Carolina in mid-August, General Cornwallis had taken a pause. Later, General Clinton would criticize this delay, since there was no real organized resistance to the British in North Carolina, in the weeks following Camden. Continental General Horatio Gates had fled to Hillsboro, and most of his Continentals were killed or captured at Camden. The militia who had fled the field at Camden largely returned home, meaning there was no army to contest the British under Cornwallis. But Cornwallis had his own difficulties. In order to win Camden, he had to engage in a rapid march, followed immediately by a battle, which completely exhausted his men. The South Carolina summer was brutally hot. The men needed time to recover. There were also still partisans in South Carolina, which threatened British supply lines. Cornwallis had deployed forces to disperse them before he stretched his lines even further. Another concern was that one of his top field commanders, Colonel Bannister Tarleton, was struck by the most relentless enemy of the war, disease. Tarleton had to take to his bed for several weeks with a bad case of yellow fever. So it was not until September 8th that Cornwallis began to march his army into North Carolina toward the town of Charlotte, with the eventual goal of reaching Hillsboro. Because he had to leave a garrison at Camden, Cornwallis commanded a force of only about 2,200 men, about 1,500 regulars and 700 loyalists. Now, even after resting at Camden for weeks, the 50-mile march to Charlotte proved frustratingly slow. Disease had spread through the British ranks, requiring Cornwallis to pause again just south of Charlotte for several more weeks. It wasn't until September 26th that he felt his men were ready to take the town. Cornwallis ordered Major George Hanger to lead the advance force into town. Hanger has an interesting story in his own right. He was born in Britain to a baron. Hanger trained for the military from an early age, but he was not the firstborn son, so he could not expect to inherit his father's title. He looked to a career in the British Army. Hanger had attended Eton, went to the University of Göttingen in what is today Germany. It was common for British officers to serve alongside Prussians, who were a traditional ally of Britain. But I find it odd for a teenager to actually start his military career in this foreign army. It didn't last long, because by age 19, Hanger had purchased an ensign's commission in the British Army. 5 years later, in 1776, he purchased a promotion to lieutenant. However, after a more junior officer purchased a commission above him, Hanger resigned and returned to Europe. There, he joined a Hessian regiment that was headed to America. So, this former British officer was now a Hessian captain who would serve under British commanders while leading a Hessian cavalry company. By 1780, now Major Hanger was serving as a major in Bannister Tarleton's Legion. With Colonel Tarleton sick with yellow fever, Hanger was the man who led the cavalry into Charlotte. Like Tarleton, Hanger hoped that speed would give him an advantage. He rushed his 150 cavalrymen into the town ahead of the advancing infantry. The Americans, however, were aware for weeks that the British planned to attack the town, and they were waiting. Although the Americans did not have enough forces to defend the town, they did leave a force to contest the British entry. The American defenses fell to the command of Colonel William Davy. Despite his rank, Colonel Davy was only 24 years old. He had been a law student in the early part of the war and had never served until 1778. Even then, it was only a brief militia force that never saw combat, after which he had returned to his studies. In the spring of 1779, though, after the British had captured Georgia, Davy helped form a new cavalry company in Salisbury, North Carolina. He started service as lieutenant in 1779, but rose quickly in rank. In May of 1779, Davy served under the command of General Pulaski, who promoted the young officer at Charleston. Davy led a charge at the Battle of Stono Ferry, where he suffered a serious wound and narrowly avoided capture. He left active service to recuperate and found time to pass the bar in November of 1779. But by the summer of 1780, Davy had recuperated from his wounds and formed a new independent cavalry company. Sometime over the summer, Davy also received his promotion to colonel in the South Carolina Cavalry. His company hoped to catch up with the army under General Gates at Camden, but arrived too late to participate. Instead of retreating with Gates and the remnants of the army, Davy continued south to recover supply wagons and scout enemy movements. And Colonel Davy received orders to cover the American withdrawal from Charlotte, North Carolina, as the British army approached. Davy's 150 mounted militia formed the defense at Charlotte behind various stone walls near the center of town. Only a portion of his men held the center, with others, some still mounted, guarding the flanks or held in reserve. Davy was facing Cornwallis's full army of 2,200 men, so there was no expectation that the defenses would hold for long. When British Major Hanger entered Charlotte with 150 members of Tarleton's cavalry on September 26th, they ran straight into Davy's South Carolina militia, who held the high ground behind stone walls. The British cavalry was used to rushing the enemy with enthusiasm in hopes of unnerving the defenders and breaking their lines. Instead, the British ran into a volley of fire and were forced to withdraw. A firefight ensued from a distance as the British cavalry waited for their infantry to catch up with them. Once the infantry did arrive, the British could use their superior numbers to advance forward, taking cover behind houses and walls. The Americans realized that if they continued to hold their position, they might be encircled and captured. Instead, Davy ordered a disciplined withdrawal. The British pursued and began a second firefight about a mile outside of town. The Americans fired back, but continued to retreat, resulting in a running firefight over the next 5 miles. The fighting eventually reached the camp of General Jethro Sumner, who had a much larger force of Americans. Even so, the British cavalry pushed in Sumner's pickets and continued to press forward before finally being driven back by superior numbers. By this time it was getting dark, so the British Legion returned to Charlotte for the night. The Americans then withdrew about 16 miles away to avoid another battle that might involve the entire British army under Cornwallis. The British took the town, as expected, but suffered 44 casualties. The Americans suffered only 11. The British occupied Charlotte, but would continue to face harassing fire for weeks following the occupation. Any foraging parties would regularly come under attack from American militia. It got so bad that Cornwallis had to send half his force, about 1,000 men, with the foraging parties to provide cover. The thick woods surrounding the town provided effective cover and made pursuit particularly difficult. Cornwallis also found himself nearly cut off. Attempts to send messengers back to South Carolina almost always resulted in their capture. A week after taking Charlotte, General Cornwallis, in a letter to another officer, commented, "This country of Mecklenburg is the most rebellious and inveterate that I have ever met with in this country, not excepting any part of the Jerseys." Given the violent reaction to the British Army's presence, Cornwallis once again delayed any plans to march further north and take Hillsborough, which was still 140 miles away. Instead, his army hunkered down and awaited Loyalist reinforcements under the command of Major Patrick Ferguson. Now, about the same time that Cornwallis had begun his march into North Carolina, Major Ferguson had also begun his own advance. Ferguson planned to move from western South Carolina into western North Carolina. This would protect Cornwallis's flank and also give Ferguson an opportunity to recruit Loyalists in that region. A few months earlier, North Carolina Loyalists had begun to form on their own, only to get shut down by the Patriots at the Battle of Ramsar's Mill. So while this was hostile territory for the British, they also had good reason to believe that a fair portion of the population was ready to join them. Now, in some ways, this really is a dangerous maneuver. Cornwallis was dividing his forces in hostile territory. Ferguson started out with only about 300 men, most of them local militia, when he had begun his march. The British believed that the risk was a reasonably small one because American resistance had appeared to fall apart after Camden. Only small bands of rebels still roamed around. Ferguson believed that his small brigade could handle whatever they would confront. As Ferguson's men moved north, the plan seemed to work pretty well. He managed to recruit another 900 Loyalists as he moved into western North Carolina, bringing his total force to around 1,200 men, about half of what Cornwallis commanded. If Ferguson had just marched with Cornwallis, he never would have had the opportunity to recruit these new reinforcements. In early September, weeks before Cornwallis was able to take Charlotte, Ferguson's men moved to Gilbertown, North Carolina, a small town about 55 miles west of Charlotte. They engaged in some skirmishing, but found that many of the locals were inclined to cooperate. Many locals came in to take oaths of allegiance. What the British did not know was that American officers had told the locals to do this in order to protect their herds of cattle. If they had refused to take an oath, the British would have seized or slaughtered their herds. The Americans wanted these herds protected for when they took back control of the region. So, believing he had the advantage, on September 10th, Ferguson released one of his prisoners with a message. He ordered the man to ride west from Gilbertown and find American Colonel Isaac Shelby and deliver a message to all people living in the West, known as the Overmountain Men. Ferguson informed them that if they did not end all resistance, that he would march his Loyalist army over the mountains and, quote, hang their leaders and lay their country waste with fire and sword. Isaac Shelby, who I think I last discussed in episode 260, led a group of Patriot militia who had fought some particularly brutal fighting, including Musgrove's Mill, before retreating further west to the frontier settlements. Colonel Shelby had been coordinating with other militia leaders to get a large enough force to challenge Ferguson's Loyalist army. Over the next couple of weeks, the Patriots assembled such an army, led by men including John Sevier, Charles McDowell, and William Campbell. The smaller bands converged at Sycamore Shoals in what is today eastern Tennessee. These were all militiamen. Some were refugees from battles in South Carolina. A good portion of them were Virginia militia who had been fighting in the Carolinas for some time. Still others were the Overmountain Men who lived in what is today Tennessee. These men were motivated to prevent Ferguson from carrying the war to them, where Ferguson might raise Indian allies to wipe out frontier settlements that would kill all men, women, and children. The Overmountain Men were able to negotiate at least a temporary truce with the local Cherokee. This allowed them to take their forces east, leave their homes relatively unprotected, and challenge Ferguson near his headquarters at Gilbertown. This force of about 1,100 men crossed over the mountains, moving east. By September 30th, they arrived at Quaker Meadows, where they met up with Wilkes County Militia, which turned out under the command of Colonel Benjamin Cleveland. So by this time, the total force had grown to about 1,400 men. Now, one important commander who was not with the army was General Thomas Sumter. As you may recall, Sumter was a South Carolina officer who had dropped out of the war, only to join again after British cavalry attempted to arrest him and burned his plantation. Sumter had gathered a small army of militia under his command with no real authority and had assumed the rank of general to command them. Now, while Sumter was still fighting in the backcountry, another officer, Colonel James Williams, carried several dozen British prisoners to Hillsborough, North Carolina, where the South Carolina governor John Rutledge had set up his government in exile. Rutledge at that point commissioned Williams as general of militia. With his commission in hand, Williams rode into Sumter's camp along the Catawba River sometime in September and informed all of Sumter's men that they were now under his command. The men refused, saying that they would serve only under Sumter. They voted to send a delegation to Hillsborough to get this sorted out with Governor Rutledge. The delegation, including Sumter and most of his top officers, left for Hillsborough on September 30th. At the same time, the Overmountain Men were assembling to attack Ferguson. While they were away, the bulk of his forces remained where they were, with two of Sumter's aides taking temporary command. Now, after Sumter and his men reached Governor Rutledge a few days later, he acceded to their requests and granted Sumter a formal commission as Brigadier General and as commander of all South Carolina militia. With this formal commission, Sumter returned to his men, but events had overtaken him. While he was away, the assembled force of Overmountain men had moved east to confront Major Ferguson's loyalists at Gilberttown. Aware that an enemy force was approaching, Ferguson moved to some high ground in the area, a hill known as King's Mountain. It was there that he will hold out until General Cornwallis could send a relief force. And we'll have to discuss the results of that battle next week when we finally reach the Battle of King's Mountain. Hey, thanks for joining the American Revolution Podcast After Show. Thanks to my Patreon supporters in the Alexander Hamilton Club, George Davis, Mike Hager, and Michael Gaylord, and to Robert Morris Circle supporters Lee Seam, Mike Mulhern, and TJ Walker. Thanks also to my new standard bearers, Ryan Houston, Jim Gallagher, Chris Mielke, and General Jason Baum. You will receive your first flag magnet this month. My supporters at the standard bearer level or higher receive a different magnet each month with a flag from the American Revolution. I also want to thank Thomas Thompson and Peggy Hawkins for one-time gifts via PayPal or Venmo. Almost 2 years ago, I announced my offer to quit my day job and work full-time on this podcast if I could get 300 people to support me with monthly pledges on Patreon. We haven't met that goal, and I ended up having to cut back my episode releases from every week to every other week because of the demands of my day job. Now, I just wanted to mention that although we're still pretty far from 300, my offer still stands. If I can get 300 subscribers, I will quit my day job and devote myself full-time to this podcast. That will mean going back to weekly releases, more special episodes, and so much more if I can devote all of my time to this podcast. And for those of you who already support me, thank you so much. Many of you have been incredibly generous. And if you can't afford to chip in, that's fine too. My main goal in this podcast is helping people to learn about the revolution. Even if you can't afford to support it financially, I really am grateful that you're taking the time to listen. But if there's anything else you can do to help spread the word about this podcast, to help more people to find it, I'd really appreciate that as well. Another reminder to everyone, I'm going to be attending some live events this spring. I'm going to be at the American Revolution Authors Congress at Washington's Crossing in Pennsylvania on April 15th. The sponsors of that event were actually able to get their costs covered, so the event is free for anyone who would like to attend. It's going to be a great event. A lot of authors of books related to the American Revolution are going to be there speaking. I'm going to be there talking as well. Should be a lot of fun. I also plan to speak at History Camp Valley Forge. Some people think from the name History Camp that the event is for kids. It's not. The event is almost entirely attended by adults. We're mostly amateur historians. Many of the folks who are going to be presenting have spent years becoming experts on a particular topic of history, and they want to present what they know to others. History Camp has been a really big event in Boston for over a decade. This is the first such event in Philadelphia. We had originally scheduled one for 2020, but it got killed because of the pandemic. But I hope this will become an annual event like the one in Boston. For more details on either of these events, visit my website, www.amrevpodcast.com. While there, you may also want to join my mailing list with MailChimp. I promise you won't get very much mail. I probably don't send out an email more than once a month and primarily use it to let people know about upcoming live or online events. Now, this week, General Cornwallis finally made his move into North Carolina. At this point in the war, the British were trying to secure the southern colonies where they thought loyalist sentiment was much stronger. In fact, early in the war, it may have been, but the British had ignored the southern colonies for so long that the Patriots had largely silenced the Loyalists, who might have been inclined to greet the British Army as liberators. Other than a half-hearted attempt to involve North Carolina in 1776, which was snuffed out at the Battle of Moore's Creek Bridge, the British largely ignored the colony until 1780. This gave the Patriots years to secure control of the colony and convinced most of the inhabitants that they were the legitimate government. Now, while there were clearly some loyalists who were lying low, the regular army's inability to provide a rallying point or convince the locals that they were there to stay minimized loyalists' ability to rise up and make a stand. Now, there clearly was a large faction of the state that supported independence from the beginning, and which was willing to fight for that status against loyalists and regulars alike. Cornwallis found Charlotte, much like other northern cities, where the British occupied the town, but could not ride around the countryside in small numbers, they were always under siege, and could not rally the population to join them. The British never seemed to be able to crack this problem in America, which really was the result of their eventual loss of the war. Now, of course, pressure to join the Patriot cause in North Carolina, as in all the states, was immense, and there were pretty terrible punishments for those who remained loyal to the king. If you want to read more about this, my book recommendation this week is The Loyalists of North Carolina by Robert DeMond. The book makes the case that North Carolina may have had the highest percentage of loyalists of any colony, but through a sustained campaign by the Patriots, they were able to suppress loyalist activity, and that by the time the British finally reached North Carolina in 1780, the loyalists were in no position to help. The book was first published in 1940, but has been through several reprints. I couldn't find much detail about the author, Robert DeMond, but he appears to have been a college professor, and he died in 1959. His work, The Loyalists of North Carolina, seems to have been the main written work of his life. My online recommendation this week is an older book called The Life, Adventures, and Opinions of Colonel George Hanger, written by himself. Hanger, of course, was Tarleton's second in command in 1780, and the officer who led the first British troops into Charlotte. Hanger was an interesting character. I alluded to him in the main part of the podcast. He had an odd relationship with the British Army after coming to America as a Hessian officer, despite being an Englishman. After returning to Britain, Hanger wrote a defense of his commander, Colonel Bannister Tarleton, during an ongoing public debate over the war in the South in the early 1780s. Hanger also became best buds with the Prince of Wales, the future King George IV. He wrote this somewhat rambling autobiography of his early life serving in America, combined with observations on all sorts of other things, in 1801. It's an interesting read by someone who lived out the events that we discussed this week. As always, I've included links to the book available on archive.org from my website and blog. My question this week asks, could Great Britain have retained the U.S. as a colony if during the War of Independence they had offered a negotiated settlement? What's the best deal Britain could have got that the U.S. would have accepted? Well, Britain did attempt a negotiated settlement. In 1778, it sent the Carlisle Commission to Philadelphia with negotiating instructions that pretty much anything was on the table short of complete independence. And I talked about this in much more detail in episode 186. But the Continental Congress refused even to meet with the commissioners. If the British government had sent negotiators in late 1775 or early 1776, even after the war had broken out, but before the king told Parliament that they should crush the rebellion militarily, they probably could have gotten a pretty good deal. A guarantee of no internal taxation, a promise to respect colonial charters, and the creation of a structure for mediating future concerns probably would have been enough to end the war, and the colonists would have celebrated the king once again as the defender of English liberties. So there was about a one-year window after the Battle of Lexington where this strategy would have worked. But after word arrived in the colonies about the king's desire to crush them militarily, there really was no going back. At that point, it was independence or bust. If you have a question you'd like me to answer, please reach out to me via email or on Twitter, Facebook, Quora, or Reddit. Well, that's all for this time. I hope you will join me again next time for another American Revolution podcast.